Side 6, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with the Appendix to Narn Ihin Hurin, on page 151. Yet, and strange it seemed to them, with Turin it went otherwise, and he became ever more friendly with the old dwarf, and listened more and more to his counsels. In the winter that followed, he would sit for long hours with Mim, listening to his lore and the tales of his life. Nor did Turin rebuke him if he spoke ill of the Eldar. Mim seemed well pleased, and showed much favor to Turin in return. Him only would he admit to his smithy at times, and there they would talk softly together. Less pleased were the men, and Ondrog looked on with a jealous eye. Editor. The text followed in the Silmarillion gives no indication of how Beleg found his way into Bar and Donwith. He appeared suddenly among them in the dim dusk of a winter's day. In other brief outlines, the story is that through the improvidence of the outlaws, food became short in Bar and Donwith during the winter, and Mim begrudged them the edible roots from his store. Therefore, in the beginning of the year, they went out on a hunting foray from the stronghold. Beleg, approaching Amun-Ruv, came upon their tracks, and either trailed them to a camp, which they were forced to make in a sudden snowstorm, or followed them back to Bar and Donwith, and slipped in after them. At this time, Ondrog, seeking for Mim's secret store of food, became lost in the caves, and found a hidden stair that led out onto the flat summit of Amun-Ruv. It was by this stair that some of the outlaws fled from Bar and Donwith when it was attacked by the orcs. The Silmarillion, page 206. And either during the foray just mentioned, or on a later occasion, Ondrog, having taken up again bow and arrows in defiance of Mim's curse, was wounded by a poisoned shaft. In one only of several references to the event said to have been an orc arrow. Ondrog was cured of this wound by Beleg, but it seems that his dislike and distrust of the elf was not thereby mitigated, and Mim's hatred of Beleg became all the fiercer, for he had thus undone his curse upon Ondrog. "It will bite again," he said. It came into Mim's mind that if he also ate the lembas of Melion, he would renew his youth and grow strong again, and since he could not come at it by stealth, he feigned sickness and begged it of his enemy. When Beleg refused it to him, the seal was set upon Mim's hatred, and all the more because of Turin's love for the elf. It may be mentioned here that when Beleg brought out the lembas from his pack, see the Silmarillion, pages 202 and 204, Turin refused it. Author. The silver leaves were red in the firelight, and when Turin saw the seal, his eyes darkened. "What have you there?" he said. "The greatest gift that one who loves you still has to give," answered Beleg. "Here is lembas, the waybread of the Eldar, that no man yet has tasted." "The helm of my fathers I take," said Turin, "with good will for your keeping, but I will not receive gifts out of Dorioth." "Then send back your sword and your arms," said Beleg. "Send back also the teaching and fostering of your youth, and let your men die in the desert to please your mood. Nonetheless, this waybread was a gift not to you, but to me, and I may do with it as I will. Eat it not, if it sticks in your throat, but others here may be more hungry and less proud." Then Turin was abashed, and in that matter overcame his pride. Editor. Some slight further indications are found concerning Dor Cuarthol, the land of bow and helm, where Beleg and Turin for a time became from their stronghold on Amun-Ruv the leaders of a strong force in the lands south of Taglin. The Silmarillion, page 205. Author. Turin received gladly all who came to him, but by the counsel of Beleg he admitted no newcomer to his refuge upon Amun-Ruv, and that was now named Echad Isedrin, Camp of the Faithful. The way thither only those of the old company knew, and no others were admitted. But other guarded camps and forts were established round about, in the forest eastward, or in the highlands, or in the southward fens, from Methed Englad, the end of the wood, to Bar Erib, some leagues south of Amun-Ruv. And from all these places men could see the summit of Amun-Ruv, and by signals receive tidings and commands. In this way, before the summer had passed, the following of Turin was swelled to a great force, and the power of Angband was thrown back. Word of this came even to Nargothrond, and many there grew restless, saying that if an outlaw could do such hurt to the enemy, what might not the lord of Narog do? But Aradhrith would not change his counsels. In all things he followed Thingol, with whom he exchanged messengers by secret ways. And he was a wise lord, according to the wisdom of those who considered first their own people, and how long they might preserve their life and wealth against the lust of the north. Therefore he allowed none of his people to go to Turin, and he sent messengers to say to him that in all that he might do or devise in his war, he should not set foot in the land of Nargothrond, nor drive orcs thither. But help other than in arms he offered to the two captains, should they have need. And in this, it is thought, he was moved by Thingol and Melion. Editor, it is several times emphasized that Beleg remained throughout opposed to Turin's grand design, although he supported him, that it seemed to him that the Dragonhelm had worked otherwise with Turin than he had hoped, and that he foresaw with a troubled mind what the days to come would bring. Scraps of his words with Turin on these matters are preserved. In one of these, they sat in the stronghold of Echad Isedrin together, and Turin said to Beleg, Author, why are you sad and thoughtful? Does not all go well since you returned to me? Has not my purpose proved good? All is well now, said Beleg. Our enemies are still surprised and afraid, and still good days lie before us for a while. And what then? Winter, and after that another year, for those who live to see it. And what then? The wrath of Angband. We have burned the fingertips of the Black Hand. No more. It will not withdraw. But is not the wrath of Angband our purpose and delight? Said Turin. What else would you have me do? You know full well, said Beleg, but of that road you have forbidden me to speak. But hear me now. The lord of a great host has many needs. He must have a secure refuge, and he must have wealth, and many whose work is not in war. With numbers comes the need of food, more than the wild will furnish, and there comes the passing of secrecy. Amun-Ruth is a good place for a few. It has eyes and ears, but it stands alone, and is seen far off, and no great force is needed to surround it. Nonetheless, I will be the captain of my own host, said Turin. And if I fall, then I fall. Here I stand in the path of Morgoth, and while I so stand, he cannot use the southward road. For that, in Nargothrond, there should be some thanks, and even help with needful things. Editor, in another brief passage of speech between them, Turin replied to Beleg's warnings of the frailty of his power in these words. Author, I wish to rule a land, but not this land. Here I desire only to gather strength. To my father's land, in Dor Lomond, my heart turns, and thither I shall go when I may. Editor, it is also asserted that Morgoth, for a time, withheld his hand and made mere feints of attack, so that by easy victory the confidence of these rebels might become overweening, as it proved, indeed. Andrag appears again in an outline of the course of the assault on Amun-Ruth. It was only then that he revealed to Turin the existence of the Inner Stair, and he was one of those who came by that way to the summit. There he is said to have fought more valiantly than any, but he fell at last mortally wounded by an arrow, and thus the curse of Mim was fulfilled. To the tale in the Silmarillion of Beleg's journey in pursuit of Turin, his meeting with Gwyndor and Taur Nufuin, the rescue of Turin, and Beleg's death at Turin's hands, there is nothing of any moment to add. For Gwyndor's possession of one of the blue-shining Feanorian lamps, and the part that this lamp played in a version of the story, see page 51 above, note 2. It may be noted here that it was my father's intention to extend the history of the Dragonhelm of Dor Lomond into the period of Turin's sojourn in Nargothrond, and even beyond. But this was never incorporated into the narratives. In the existing versions, the helm disappears with the end of Dor Cuarthol, in the destruction of the outlaw's stronghold on Amun-Ruth. but in some way it was to reappear in Turin's possession at Nargothrond. It could only have come there if it had been taken by the orcs that carried Turin off to Angband, but its recovery from them at the time of Turin's rescue by Beleg and Gwyndor would have required some development of the narrative at that point. An isolated scrap of writing tells that in Nargothrond, Turin would not wear the helm again, lest it reveal him, but that he wore it when he went to the Battle of Tumhalad. The Silmarillion, page 212, where he is said to have worn the dwarf mask that he found in the armories of Nargothrond. This note continues. Author: for fear of that helm, all foes avoided him, and thus it was that he came off unhurt from that deadly field. It was thus that he came back to Nargothrond, wearing the dragon helm, and Glaurung, desiring to rid Turin of its aid and protection, since he himself feared it, taunted him, saying that surely Turin claimed to be his vassal and retainer, since he bore his master's likeness on the crest of his helm. But Turin answered, "Thou liest, and knowest it, for this image was made in scorn of thee, and while there is one to bear it, doubt shall ever assail thee, lest the bearer deal thee thy doom." "Then it must await a master of another name," said Glaurung. "For Turin, son of Hurin, I do not fear. Otherwise, is it? For he has not the hardihood to look me in the face, openly." And indeed, so great was the terror of the dragon that Turin dared not look straight upon his eye, but had kept the visor of his helmet down, shielding his face, and in his parley had looked no higher than Glaurung's feet. But being thus taunted, in pride and rashness he thrust up the visor and looked Glaurung in the eye. Editor: in another place there is a note that it was when Morwen heard in Doriath of the appearance of the dragon helm at the Battle of Tumhalad that she knew that the tale was true, that the Mormigil was indeed Turin, her son. Finally, there is a suggestion that Turin was to wear the helm when he slew Glaurung, and would taunt the dragon at his death with his words at Nargothrond about a master of another name. But there is no indication of how the narrative was to be managed to bring this about. There is an account of the nature and substance of Gwyndor's opposition to Turin's policies in Nargothrond, which in the Silmarillion is only very briefly referred to. Page 211. This account is not fully formed into narrative, but may be represented thus. Author: Gwyndor spoke ever against Turin in the Council of the King, saying that he had been in Angband and knew somewhat of the might of Morgoth and of his designs. "Petty victories will prove profitless at the last," he said, "for thus Morgoth learns where the boldest of his enemies are to be found, and gathers strength great enough to destroy them. All the might of the elves and the Edain united sufficed only to contain him, and to gain the peace of a siege. Long indeed, but only so long as Morgoth bided his time before he broke the leaguer, and never again can such a union be made. In secrecy only lies now any hope, until the Valar come." "The Valar," said Turin, "they have forsaken you, and they hold men in scorn. What use to look westward across the endless sea? There is but one Valar with whom we have to do, and that is Morgoth. And if in the end we cannot overcome him, at the least we can hurt him and hinder him. For victory is victory, however small, nor is its worth only in what follows from it. But it is expedient also, for if you do nothing to halt him, all Beleriand will fall beneath his shadow before many years are past, and then one by one he will smoke you out of your earths. And what then? A pitiable remnant will fly south and west to cower on the shores of the sea, caught between Morgoth and Ossé. Better than to win a time of glory, though it be short-lived, for the end will be no worse. You speak of secrecy, and say that therein lies the only hope. But could you ambush and waylay every scout and spy of Morgoth to the last and least, so that none came ever back with tidings to Angband, yet from that he would learn that you lived, and guess where? And this also, I say, though mortal men have little life beside the span of the elves, they would rather spend it in battle than fly or submit. The defiance of Hurin Tholion is a great deed, and though Morgoth slay the doer, he cannot make the deed not to have been. Even the lords of the West will honor it, and is it not written into the history of Arda, which neither Morgoth nor Manwë can unwrite? You speak of high things, Gwyndor answered, and plain it is that you have lived among the Eldar. But a darkness is on you, if you set Morgoth and Manwë together, or speak of the Valar as the foes of elves or men. For the Valar scorn nothing, and least of all the children of Ilúvatar, nor do you know all the hopes of the Eldar. It is a prophecy among us that one day a messenger from Middle-earth will come through the shadows to Valinor, and Manwë will hear, and Mondos relent. For that time shall we not attempt to preserve the seed of the Noldor, and of the Edain also? And Círdan dwells now in the south, and there is building of ships. But what know you of ships, or of the sea? You think of yourself, and of your own glory, and bid us each do likewise. But we must think of others beside ourselves, for not all can fight and fall, and those we must keep from war and ruin while we can. Then send them to your ships while there is yet time, said Turin. They will not be parted from us, said Gwyndor. Even could Círdan sustain them. We must abide together as long as we may, and not court death. All this I have answered, said Turin. Valiant defense of the borders and hard blows ere the enemy gathers. In that course lies the best hope of your long abiding together. And of those that you speak of love such skulkers in the woods, hunting always like a wolf, better than one who puts on his helm and figured shield and drives away the foe, be they far greater than all his host? At least the women of the Edain do not. They did not hold back the men from the Nirnaeth Arnoidiad. But they suffered greater woe than if that field had not been fought, said Gwyndor. Editor, the love of Finduilas for Turin was also to be more fully treated. Author, Finduilas, the daughter of Aradreth, was golden-haired after the manner of the House of Finarfin, and Turin began to take pleasure in the sight of her and in her company, for she reminded him of his kindred and the women of Dor Lomond in his father's house. At first he met her only when Gwyndor was by, but after a while she sought him out, and they met at times alone, though it seemed to be chance. Then she would question him about the Edain, of whom she had seen few and seldom, and about his country and his kin. Then Turin spoke freely to her concerning these things, though he did not name the land of his birth, nor any of his kindred. And on a time he said to her, I had a sister, Lalaith, or so I named her, and of her you put me in mind. But Lalaith was a child, a yellow flower in the green grass of spring, and had she lived, she would now, maybe, have become dimmed with grief. But you are queenly, and as a golden tree. I would I had a sister so fair. But you are kingly, said she, even as the lords of the people of Fingolfin. I would I had a brother so valiant. And I do not think that Agarwain is your true name, nor is it fit for you. Adanavel, I call you Thurin, the secret. At this, Turin started, but he said, That is not my name, and I am not a king, for our kings are of the Eldar, as I am not. Now Turin marked that Gwyndor's friendship grew cooler towards him, and he wondered also that whereas at first the woe and horror of Angband had begun to be lifted from him, now he seemed to slip back into care and sorrow. And he thought, It may be that he is grieved that I oppose his counsels and have overcome him. I would it were not so, for he loved Gwyndor as his guide and healer, and was filled with pity for him. But in those days the radiance of Finduilas also became dimmed, her footsteps slow, and her face grave. And Turin, perceiving this, surmised that the words of Gwyndor had set fear in her heart of what might come to pass. In truth, Finduilas was torn in mind, for she honored Gwyndor and pitied him, and wished not to add one tear to his suffering. But against her will, her love for Turin grew day by day, and she thought of Beren and Lúthien. But Turin was not like Beren. He did not scorn her, and was glad in her company. Yet she knew that he had no love of the kind she wished. His mind and heart were elsewhere, by rivers and springs long past. Then Turin spoke to Finduilas and said, Do not let the words of Gwyndor affright you. He has suffered in the darkness of Angband. and it is hard for one so valiant to be thus crippled and backward perforce. He needs all solace, and a longer time for healing.
I know it well, she said.
But we will win that time for him, said Turin. Nargothrond shall stand. Never again will Morgoth the Craven come forth from Angband, and all his reliance must be on his servants. Thus says Melion of Dorioth. They are the fingers of his hands, and we will smite them and cut them off till he draws back his claws. Nargothrond shall stand.
Perhaps, said Finduilas, it shall stand, if you can achieve it. But have a care, Adonathel. My heart is heavy when you go out to battle, lest Nargothrond be bereaved.
And afterwards Turin sought out Gwyndor and said to him, Gwyndor, dear friend, you are falling back into sadness. Do not so, for your healing will come in the houses of your kin, and in the light of Finduilas. Then Gwyndor stared at Turin, but he said nothing, and his face was clouded. Why do you look upon me so? Said Turin. Often your eyes have gazed strangely at me of late. How have I grieved you? I have opposed your counsels, but a man must speak as he sees, nor hide the truth that he believes for any private cause. I would that we were one in mind. For to you I owe a great debt, and I shall not forget it. Will you not? Said Gwyndor. Nonetheless, your deeds and your counsels have changed my home and my kin. Your shadow lies upon them. Why should I be glad, who have lost all to you? But Turin did not understand these words, and did but guess that Gwyndor begrudged him his place in the heart and counsels of the king. Editor. A passage follows in which Gwyndor warned Finduilas against her love for Turin, telling her who Turin was, and this is closely based on the text given in the Silmarillion, pages 210 and 211. But at the end of Gwyndor's speech, Finduilas answers him at greater length than in the other version. Author. Your eyes are dimmed, Gwyndor, she said. You do not see or understand what is here come to pass. Must I now be put to double shame to reveal the truth to you? For I love you, Gwyndor, and I am ashamed that I love you not more, but have taken a love even greater, from which I cannot escape. I did not seek it, and long I put it aside. But if I have pity for your hurts, have pity on mine. Turin loves me not, nor will. You say this, said Gwyndor, to take the blame from him whom you love. Why does he seek you out, and sit long with you, and come ever more glad away?
Because he also needs solace, said Finduilas, and is bereaved of his kin. You both have your needs. But what of Finduilas?
Now is it not enough that I must confess myself to you unloved, but that you should say that I speak so to deceive? Nay, a woman is not easily deceived in such a case, said Gwyndor. Nor will you find many who will deny that they are loved, if that is true.
If any of us three be faithless, it is I, but not in will.
But what of your doom and rumors of Angband? What of death and destruction? The Adonathel is mighty in the tale of the world, and his stature shall reach yet to Morgoth in some far day to come.
He is proud, said Gwyndor.
But also he is merciful, said Finduilas. He is not yet awake, but still pity can ever pierce his heart, and he will never deny it. Pity maybe shall be ever the only entry, but he does not pity me. He holds me in awe, as were I both his mother and a queen.
Maybe Finduilas spoke truly, seeing with the keen eyes of the Eldar. And now Turin, not knowing what had passed between Gwyndor and Finduilas, was ever gentler towards her, as she seemed more sad. But on a time, Finduilas said to him,
Thurin Adonathel, why did you hide your name from me?
Had I known who you were, I should not have honored you less, but I should better have understood your grief.
What do you mean? He said. Whom do you make me?
Turin, son of Hurin Thalion, captain of the North.
Editor. Then Turin rebuked Gwyndor for revealing his true name, as is told in the Silmarillion, page 211. One other passage in this part of the narrative exists in a fuller form than in the Silmarillion. Of the Battle of Tumhalad and the sack of Nargothrond there is no other account. While the speeches of Turin and the dragon are so fully recorded in the Silmarillion that it seems unlikely that they would have been further expanded,
This passage is a much fuller account of the coming of the elves Gelmir and Arminas to Nargothrond in the year of its fall. The Silmarillion, pages 211 and 212. For their earlier encounter with Tuor and Dor Loman, which is referred to here, see pages 21 and 22 above. Author. In the spring there came two elves, and they named themselves Gelmir and Arminas, of the people of Finarfin, and said that they had an errand to the lord of Nargothrond. They were brought before Turin, but Gelmir said, "It is to Orodreth, Finarfin's son, that we would speak." And when Orodreth came, Gelmir said to him, "Lord, we were of Angrod's people, and we have wandered far since the Dagor Bragolach, but of late we have dealt among Círdons, following by the mouths of Sirion. And on a day he called us, and bade us go to you. For Ulmo himself, the Lord of Waters, had appeared to him, and warned him of great peril that draws near to Nargothrond." But Orodreth was wary, and he answered, "Why then do you come hither out of the north? Or perhaps you had other errands also?" Then Arminas said, "Lord, ever since the Nirnaeth I have sought for the hidden kingdom of Turgon, and I have found it not. And in this search I fear now that I have delayed our errand hither over long. For Círdon sent us along the coast by ship, for secrecy and speed, and we were put ashore in Drengist. But among the sea folk were some that came south in past years as messengers from Turgon, and it seemed to me from their guarded speech that maybe Turgon dwells still in the north, and not in the south, as most believe. But we have found neither sign nor rumor of what we sought." "Why do you seek Turgon?" said Orodreth. "Because it is said that his kingdom shall stand longest against Morgoth," answered Arminas. And those words seemed to Orodreth ill-omened, and he was displeased. "Then tarry not in Nargothrond," he said, "for here you will hear no news of Turgon, and I need none to teach me that Nargothrond stands in peril." "Be not angered, lord," said Gelmir, "if we answer your questions with truth. And our wandering from the straight path hither has not been fruitless, for we have passed beyond the reach of your furthest scouts. We have traversed Dor Loman and all the lands under the eaves of Ered Wethrin, and we have explored the pass of Sirion, spying out the ways of the enemy. There is a great gathering of orcs and evil creatures in those regions, and a host is mustering about Sauron's isle." "I know it," said Turin. "Your news is stale. If the message of Círdon was to any purpose, it should have come sooner." "At least, lord, you shall hear the message now," said Gelmir to Orodreth. "Hear then the words of the Lord of Waters. Thus he spoke to Círdon the shipwright. The evil of the north has defiled the springs of Sirion, and my power withdraws from the fingers of the flowing waters. But a worse thing is yet to come forth. Say therefore to the Lord of Nargothrond, shut the doors of the fortress, and go not abroad. Cast the stones of your pride into the loud river, that the creeping evil may not find the gate." These words seemed dark to Orodreth, and he turned as he ever did to Turin for counsel. But Turin mistrusted the messengers, and he said in scorn, "What does Círdon know of our wars, who dwell nigh to the enemy? Let the mariner look to his ships. But if in truth the Lord of Waters would send us counsel, let him speak more plainly, for otherwise it will seem better in our case to muster our strength and go boldly to meet our foes ere they come too nigh." Then Gelmir bowed before Orodreth and said, "I have spoken as I was bidden, lord," and he turned away. But Arminas said to Turin, "Are you indeed of the house of Hador, as I have heard said?" "Here I am named Agarwain, the black sword of Nargothrond," said Turin. "You deal much, it seems, in guarded speech, friend Arminas, and it is well that Turgon's secret is hid from you, or soon it would be heard in Angband. A man's name is his own, and should the son of Hurin learn that you have betrayed him when he would be hid, then may Morgoth take you and burn out your tongue." Then Arminas was dismayed by the black wrath of Turin, but Gelmir said, "He shall not be betrayed by us, Agarwain. Are we not in council behind closed doors, where speech may be plainer? And Arminas asked this thing, I deem, because it is known to all that dwell by the sea that Ulmo has great love for the house of Hador, and some say that Hurin and Huor his brother came once into the hidden realm." "If that were so, then he would speak of it to none, neither the great nor the less, and least of all to his son in childhood," answered Turin. "Therefore I do not believe that Arminas asked this of me, in hope to learn aught of Turgon." I mistrust such messengers of mischief.
Save your mistrust, said Arminas in anger. Gelmir mistakes me. I asked because I doubted what here seems believed. For little indeed do you resemble the kin of Hador, whatever your name.
And what do you know of them? Said Turin.
Hurin I have seen, answered Arminas, and his fathers before him. And in the wastes of Dorloman I met with Tuor, son of Huor, Hurin's brother, and he is like his fathers, as you are not.
That may be, said Turin, though of Tuor I have heard no word ere now. But if my head be dark and not golden, of that I am not ashamed, for I am not the first of sons in the likeness of his mother. And I come through Morwen Eledwin, of the house of Beor, and the kindred of Baron Camlost.
I spoke not of the difference between the black and the gold, said Arminas, but others of the house of Hador bear themselves otherwise, and Tuor among them, for they use courtesy, and they listen to good counsel, holding the lords of the West in awe. But you, it seems, will take counsel with your own wisdom, or with your sword only, and you speak haughtily. And I say to you, Agarwain Mormegil, that if you do so, other shall be your doom than one of the houses of Hador and Beor might look for.
Other it has ever been, answered Turin. And if, as it seems, I must bear the hate of Morgoth because of the valor of my father, shall I also endure the taunts and ill-boding of a runagate, though he claim the kinship of kings? I counsel you, get you back to the safe shores of the sea.
Then Gelmir and Arminas departed and went back to the south. But despite Turin's taunts, they would gladly have awaited battle beside their kin, and they went only because Círdan had bidden them under the command of Ulmo to bring back word to him of Nargothrond and of the speeding of their errand there. And Aradhreth was much troubled by the words of the messengers, but all the more fell became the mood of Turin, and he would by no means listen to their counsels, and least of all would he suffer the great bridge to be cast down. For so much, at least, of the words of Ulmo were read aright.
Editor. It is nowhere explained why Gelmir and Arminas, on an urgent errand to Nargothrond, were sent by Círdan all the length of the coast to the Firth of Drengist. Arminas said that it was done for speed and secrecy, but greater secrecy could surely have been achieved by journeying up Narog from the south. It might be supposed that Círdan did this in obedience to Ulmo's command, so that they should meet Tuor and Dorloman and guide him through the gate of the Noldor. But this is nowhere suggested.
Part 2. The Second Age. 1. A Description of the Island of Numenor. Author. The account of the island of Numenor that here follows is derived from descriptions and simple maps that were long preserved in the archives of the kings of Gondor. These represent indeed but a small part of all that was once written, for many natural histories and geographies were composed by learned men in Numenor. But these, like nearly all else of the arts and sciences of Numenor at its high tide, disappeared in the downfall. Even such documents as were preserved in Gondor or in Imladris, where in the care of Elrond were deposited the surviving treasures of the northern Numenorean kings, suffered from loss and destruction by neglect. For though the survivors in Middle-earth yearned, as they said, for a Calebeth, the downfallen, and never even after long ages ceased to regard themselves as in a measure exiles, when it became clear that the land of gift was taken away, and that Numenor had disappeared forever, all but a few regarded study of what was left of its history as vain, breeding only useless regret. The story of Ar-Pharazôn and his impious armada was all that remained generally known in later ages. The land of Numenor resembled in outline a five-pointed star, or pentangle, with a central portion some 250 miles across, north and south, and east and west, from which extended five large peninsular promontories. These promontories were regarded as separate regions, and they were named Farostar, Northlands, Undustar, Westlands, Hjarnustar, Southwestlands, Hjarostar, Southeastlands, and Arostar, Eastlands. The central portion was called Mittelmar, Inlands, and it had no coast except the land about Romena and the head of its firth. A small part of the Mittelmar was, however, separated from the rest and called Arondor,
the Kingsland. In Arondor were the haven of Romena, the Meneltarma, and Armenelos, the city of the kings, and it was at all times the most populous region of Numenor. The Mithilmar was raised above the promontories, not reckoning the height of their mountains and hills. It was a region of grasslands and low downs, and few trees grew there. Near to the center of the Mithilmar stood the tall mountain called Meneltarma, Pillar of the Heavens, sacred to the worship of Eru Ilúvatar. Though the lower slopes of the mountain were gentle and grass-covered, it grew ever steeper, and towards the summit it could not be scaled. But a winding spiral road was made upon it, beginning at its foot upon the south, and ending below the lip of the summit upon the north. For the summit was somewhat flattened and depressed, and could contain a great multitude. But it remained untouched by hands throughout the history of Numenor. No building, no raised altar, not even a pile of undressed stones ever stood there. And no other likeness of a temple did the Numenorians possess in all the days of their grace, until the coming of Sauron. There no tool or weapon had ever been born, and there none might speak any word save the king only. Thrice only in each year the king spoke, offering prayer for the coming year at the Erechirme, in the first days of spring, praise of Eru Ilúvatar at the Eru Laitale, in midsummer, and thanksgiving to him at the Eru Hantale, at the end of autumn. At these times the king ascended the mountain on foot, followed by a great concourse of the people, clad in white and garlanded, but silent. At other times the people were free to climb to the summit alone or in company. But it is said that the silence was so great that even a stranger, ignorant of Numenor and all its history, if he were transported thither, would not have dared to speak aloud. No bird ever came there, save only eagles. If anyone approached the summit, at once three eagles would appear and alight upon three rocks near to the western edge. But at the times of the three prayers they did not descend, remaining in the sky and hovering above the people. They were called the Witnesses of Manwë, and they were believed to be sent by him from Aman to keep watch upon the holy mountain and upon all the land. The base of the Meneltarma sloped gently into the surrounding plain, but it extended, after the fashion of roots, five long low ridges outwards in the direction of the five promontories of the land. And these were called Taramasundar, the roots of the pillar. Along the crest of the southwestern ridge, the climbing road approached the mountain, and between this ridge and that on the southeast, the land went down into a shallow valley. That was named Noirinon, the Valley of the Tombs, for at its head, chambers were cut in the rock at the base of the mountain, in which were the tombs of the kings and queens of Numenor. But for the most part, the Mithilmar was a region of pastures. In the southwest, there were rolling downs of grass, and there, in the Emeria, was the chief region of the shepherds. The Ferostar was the least fertile part, stony with few trees, save that on the westward slopes of the high heather-covered moors there were woods of fir and larch. Towards the North Cape the land rose to rocky heights, and there great Sorrontil rose sheer from the sea in tremendous cliffs. Here was the abode of many eagles, and in this region Tar Meneldur Elentirmo built a tall tower, from which he could observe the motions of the stars. The Andustar was also rocky in its northern parts, with high fir woods looking out upon the sea. Three small bays it had, facing west, cut back into the highlands. But here the cliffs were in many places, not at the sea's edge, and there was a shelving land at their feet. The northmost of these was called the Bay of Andunie, for there was the great haven of Andunie, Sunset, with its town beside the shore, and many other dwellings climbing up the steep slopes behind. But much of the southerly part of the Andustar was fertile, and there also were great woods of birch and beech upon the upper ground, and in the lower vales of oaks and elms. Between the promontories of the Andustar and Hjarnustar was the great bay that was called Eldana, because it faced towards Eresea, and the lands about it, being sheltered from the north and open to the western seas, were warm, and the most rain fell there. At the center of the bay of Eldana was the most beautiful of all the havens of Numenor, Eldelonde, the Green. And hither in the early days the swift white ships of the Eldar of Eresea came most often. All about that place, up the seaward slopes and far into the land, grew the evergreen and fragrant trees that they brought out of the west, and so throve there that the Eldar said that almost it was fair as a haven in Eresea. They were the greatest delight of Numenor, and they were remembered in many songs long after they had perished forever, for few ever flowered east of the land of gift. Oi Alire, and Lyrelose, Nesamelda, Vardariana, Tanaquelase, and Yavanamare, with its globed and scarlet fruits. Flower, leaf, and rind of those trees exuded sweet scents, and all that country was full of blended fragrance. Therefore, it was called Nesimaldar, the fragrant trees. Many of them were planted and grew, though far less abundantly, in other regions of Numenor. But only here grew the mighty golden tree, Malenorne, reaching after 5 centuries a height scarce less than it achieved in Eressëa itself. Its bark was silver and smooth, and its boughs somewhat upswept after the manner of the beech. But it never grew, save with a single trunk. Its leaves, like those of the beech but greater, were pale green above, and beneath were silver, glistering in the sun. In the autumn they did not fall, but turned to pale gold. In the spring it bore golden blossom in clusters like a cherry, which bloomed on during the summer. And as soon as the flowers opened, the leaves fell, so that through spring and summer, a grove of Malenorni was carpeted and roofed with gold, but its pillars were of gray silver. Note 1. This description of the Malorn is much like that given by Legolas to his companions as they approached Lothlorien. The Fellowship of the Ring, 2:6. End of note. Its fruit was a nut with a silver shale, and some were given as a gift by Tar Aldarion, the 6th king of Numenor, to King Gil-galad of Lindon. They did not take root in that land, but Gil-galad gave some to his kinswoman, Galadriel, and under her power they grew and flourished in the guarded land of Lothlorien, beside the river Anduin, until the high elves at last left Middle-earth, but they did not reach the height or girth of the great groves of Numenor. The river Nunduine flowed into the sea at Eldalonde, and on its way made the little lake of Nissenen, that was so named from the abundance of sweet-smelling shrubs and flowers that grew upon its banks. The Hjarnustar was in its western part a mountainous region, with great cliffs on the western and southern coasts. But eastwards were great vineyards in a warm and fertile land. The promontories of the Hjarnustar and the Hjarostar were splayed wide apart, and on those long shores sea and land came gently together as nowhere else in Numenor. Here flowed down Siru, the chief river of the land. For all others, save for the Nunduine in the west, were short and swift torrents hurrying to the sea that rose in springs under the Meneltarma in the valley of Norinon, and running through the Mittelmar southwards, became in its lower course a slow and winding stream. It issued at last into the sea amid wide marshes and reedy flats, and its many small mouths found their changing paths through great sands. For many miles on either side were wide white beaches and gray shingles. And here the fisherfolk mostly dwelt, in villages upon the hards, among the marshes and meres, of which the chief was Nindamos. In the Hjarostar grew an abundance of trees of many kinds, and among them the larinque, in which the people delighted for its flowers, for it had no other use. This name they gave it, because of its long hanging clusters of yellow flowers. And some who had heard from the Eldar of Laurelin, the golden tree of Valinor, believed that it came from that great tree, being brought in seed thither by the Eldar. But it was not so. From the days of the Tar Aldarion there were great plantations in the Hjarostar to furnish timber for shipbuilding. The Hjarostar was a cooler land, but it was protected from the cold northeast winds by highlands that rose towards the end of the promontory. And in the inner regions of the Hjarostar much grain was grown, especially in those parts near to the borders of Arondor. The whole land of Numenor was so posed as if it had been thrust upward out of the sea, but tilted southward and a little eastward, and save upon the south, the land in nearly all places fell towards the sea in steep cliffs. In Numenor, birds that dwell near the sea and swim or dive in it abode in multitudes beyond reckoning. The mariners said that were they blind, they still would know that their ship was drawing near to Numenor because of the great clamor of the birds of the shore. And when any ship approached, the land sea birds in great flocks would arise and fly above it in welcome and gladness, for they were never killed or molested by intent. Some would accompany ships on their voyages, even those that went to Middle-earth. Likewise, within the lands, the birds of Numenor were beyond count. From the Kirinki, that were no bigger than wrens, but all scarlet, with piping voices on the edge of human hearing, to the great eagles that were held sacred to Manwë, and never afflicted, until the days of evil and the hatred of the Valar began. For 2,000 years, from the days of Elros Tar-Minyatur, until the time of Tar-Ankalimon, son of Tar-Atanamir. There was an eyrie in the summit of the Tower of the King's Palace in Armenelos, and there one pair ever dwelt and lived on the bounty of the king. In Numenor all journeyed from place to place on horseback, for in riding the Numenorians both men and women took delight, and all the people of the land loved horses, treating them honorably and housing them nobly. They were trained to hear and answer calls from a great distance, and it is said in old tales that where there was great love between men and women and their favorite steeds, they could be summoned at need by thought alone. Therefore the roads of Numenor were for the most part unpaved, made and tended for riding, since coaches and carriages were little used in the earlier centuries, and heavy cargoes were borne by sea. The chief and most ancient road, suitable for wheels, ran from the greatest port, Romena, in the east, to the royal city of Armenelos, and thence on to the Valley of the Tombs and the Meneltarma. And this road was early extended to Ondosta, within the borders of the Farostar, and thence to Andunia in the west. Along it passed wains bearing stone from the Northlands that was most esteemed for building, and timber in which the Westlands were rich. The Edain brought with them to Numenor the knowledge of many crafts, and many craftsmen who had learned from the Eldar, besides preserving lore and traditions of their own. But they could bring with them few materials, save for the tools of their crafts. And for long all metals in Numenor were precious metals. They brought with them many treasures of gold and silver, and gems also, but they did not find these things in Numenor. They loved them for their beauty, and was this love that first aroused in them cupidity. In later days, when they fell under the shadow and became proud and unjust in their dealings with lesser folk of Middle-earth. Of the elves of Eressëa, in the days of their friendship, they had at times gifts of gold and silver and jewels, but such things were rare and prized in all the earlier centuries, until the power of the kings was spread to the coasts of the east. Some metals they found in Numenor, and as their cunning in mining and in smelting and smithying swiftly grew, things of iron and copper became common. Among the rites of the Edain were weaponsmiths, and they had, with the teaching of the Noldor, acquired great skill in the forging of swords, of axe blades, and of spearheads and knives. Swords the guild of weaponsmiths still made, for the preservation of the craft, though most of their labor was spent on the fashioning of tools for the uses of peace. The king and most of the great chieftains possessed swords as heirlooms of their fathers, and at times they would still give a sword as a gift to their heirs. Note 2. The king's sword was indeed Aranruth, the sword of Elu Thingol of Dorioth in Beleriand, that had descended to Elros from Elwing his mother. Other heirlooms there were beside, the ring of Barahir, the great axe of Tuor, father of Earendil, and the bow of Bregor of the house of Beor. Only the ring of Barahir, father of Beren Onehand, survived the downfall, for it was given by Tar-Elendil to his daughter Silmarion, and was preserved in the house of the lords of Andunia, of whom the last was Elendil the Faithful, who fled from the wrack of Numenor to Middle-earth. Author's note. The story of the Ring of Barahir is told in the Silmarillion, chapter 19, and its later history in The Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 1, 3, and 5. Of the Great Axe of Tuor there is no mention in the Silmarillion, but it is named and described in the original Fall of Gondolin, 1916 to 1917. See page 4. Where it is said that in Gondolin, Tuor carried an axe rather than a sword, and that he named it in the speech of the people of Gondolin, Dromborleg. In a list of names accompanying the tale, Dromborleg is translated Thuttersharp. The axe of Tuor that smote both a heavy dint as of a club and cleft as a sword. End of note. A new sword was made for the king's heir to be given to him on the day on which this title was conferred. But no man wore a sword in Numenor, and for long years few indeed were the weapons of warlike intent that were made in the land. axes and spears and bows they had. And shooting with bows on foot and on horseback was a chief sport and pastime of the Numenoreans. In later days, in the wars upon Middle-earth, it was the bows of the Numenoreans that were most greatly feared. The men of the sea, it was said, send before them a great cloud, as a rain turned to serpents, or a black hail tipped with steel. And in those days, the great cohorts of the king's archers used bows made of hollow steel, with black feathered arrows a full ell long from point to notch. But for long the crews of the great Numenorean ships came unarmed among the men of Middle-earth, and though they had axes and bows aboard for the felling of timber, and the hunting for food upon wild shores owned by no man, they did not bear these when they sought out the men of the lands. It was indeed their grievance when the shadow crept along the coasts, and men whom they had befriended became afraid or hostile, that iron was used against them by those to whom they had revealed it. Beyond all other pursuits, the strong men of Numenor took delight in the sea, in swimming, in diving, or in small craft, for contests of speed in rowing or sailing. The hardiest of the people were the fisherfolk. Fish were abundant all about the coasts, and were at all times a chief source of food in Numenor, and all the towns where many people congregated were set by the shores. From the fisherfolk were mostly drawn the mariners, who, as the years passed, grew greatly in importance and esteem. It is said that when the Edain first set sail upon the great sea, following the star to Numenor, the elvish ships that bore them were each steered and captained by one of the Eldar deputed by Círdan. And after the elvish steersmen departed and took with them the most part of their ships, it was long before the Numenoreans themselves ventured far to sea. But there were shipwrights among them who had been instructed by the Eldar, and by their own study and devices they improved their art, until they dared to sail ever further into the deep waters. When 600 years had passed from the beginning of the Second Age, Veontur, captain of the king's ships under Tar-Elendil, first achieved the voyage to Middle-earth. He brought his ship, Entulesa, which signifies return, into Mithlond on the spring winds blowing from the west, and he returned in the autumn of the following year. Thereafter seafaring became the chief enterprise for daring and hardihood among the men of Numenor. And Aldarion, son of Meneldur, whose wife was Veontur's daughter, formed the Guild of Venturers, in which were joined all the tried mariners of Numenor, as is told in the tale that follows here. 2. Aldarion and Arrendis, the Mariner's Wife. Meneldur was the son of Tar-Elendil, the fourth king of Numenor. He was the king's third child, for he had two sisters, named Silmarion and Isilme. The elder of these was wedded to Elatan of Andúnie, and their son was Valandil, lord of Andúnie, from whom came long after the lines of the kings of Gondor and Arnor in Middle-earth. Meneldur was a man of gentle mood, without pride, whose exercise was rather in thought than in deeds of the body. He loved dearly the land of Numenor, and all things in it, but he gave no heed to the sea that lay all about it, for his mind looked further than Middle-earth. He was enamored of the stars and the heavens, all that he could gather of the lore of the Eldar and Edain concerning Ea, and the deeps that lay about the kingdom of Arda he studied, and his chief delight was in the watching of the stars. He built a tower in the Farostar, the northernmost region of the island, where the airs were clearest, from which by night he would survey the heavens and observe all the movements of the lights of the firmament. Note 1. In the description of Numenor, page 167, he is called Tar-Meneldur Elentirmo, Star Watcher. See also his entry in the line of Elros, page 219. End of note. When Meneldur received the scepter, he removed, as he must, from the Farostar, and dwelt in the great house of the kings in Armenelos. He proved a good and wise king, though he never ceased to yearn for days in which he might enrich his knowledge of the heavens. His wife was a woman of great beauty, named Almarion. She was the daughter of Veontur, captain of the king's ships under Tar-Elendil, and though she herself loved ships and the sea no more than most women of the land, her son followed after Veontur, her father, rather than after Meneldur. the son of Meneldur and Almarion, was Anardil, afterwards renowned among the kings of Numenor as Tar Aldarion. He had two sisters, younger than he, Ilanel and Almiel, of whom the elder married Orchaldor, a descendant of the house of Hador, son of Hotholdir, who was close in friendship with Meneldur. And the son of Orchaldor and Ilanel was Saronto, who comes later into the tale. Note 2. Saronto's part in the story can now only be glimpsed. See page 211. End of note. Aldarion, for so he is called in all tales, grew swiftly to a man of great stature, strong and vigorous in mind and body, golden-haired as his mother, ready to mirth and generous, but prouder than his father, and ever more bent on his own will. From the first, he loved the sea, and his mind was turned to the craft of shipbuilding. He had little liking for the north country, and spent all the time that his father would grant by the shores of the sea, especially near Romena, where was the chief haven of Numenor, the greatest shipyards, and the most skilled shipwrights. His father did little to hinder him for many years, being well pleased that Aldarion should have exercise for his hardihood and work for thought and hand. Aldarion was much loved by Veontur, his mother's father, and he dwelt often in Veontur's house on the southern side of the Firth of Romena. That house had its own key, to which many small boats were always moored, for Veontur would never journey by land if he could by water. And there, as a child, Aldarion learned to row, and later to manage sail. Before he was full grown, he could captain a ship of many men, sailing from haven to haven. It happened on a time that Veontur said to his grandson,
Anardilia, the spring is drawing nigh, and also the day of your full age.
For in that April, Aldarion would be 25 years old.
I have in mind a way to mark it fittingly. My own years are far greater, and I do not think that I shall often again have the heart to leave my fair house and the blessed shores of Numenor. But once more at least I would ride the great sea and face the north wind and the east. This year you shall come with me, and we will go to Mithlond and see the tall blue mountains of Middle-earth and the green land of the Eldar at their feet. Good welcome you will find from Círdan, the shipwright, and from King Gil-galad. Speak of this to your father.
Note 3. As is told in the description of Numenor, page 171, it was Veontur who first achieved the voyage to Middle-earth in the year 600 of the Second Age. He was born in 451. In the Tale of Years in Appendix B to The Lord of the Rings, the annal entry for the year 600 states, "The first ships of the Numenorians appear off the coasts." There is a description in a late philological essay of the first meeting of the Numenorians with men of Eriador at that time. It was 600 years after the departure of the survivors of the Atani, Edain, over the sea to Numenor, that a ship first came again out of the west to Middle-earth and passed up the Gulf of Lún. Its captains and mariners were welcomed by Gil-galad, and thus was begun the friendship and alliance of Numenor with the Eldar of Lindon. The news spread swiftly, and men in Eriador were filled with wonder. Although in the First Age they had dwelt in the east, rumors of the terrible war beyond the western mountains, that is, Ered Luin, had reached them. But their traditions preserved no clear account of it, and they believed that all the men who dwelt in the lands beyond had been destroyed or drowned in great tumults of fire and inrushing seas. But since it was still said among them that those men had in years beyond memory been kinsmen of their own, they sent messages to Gil-galad, asking leave to meet the shipmen who had returned from death in the deeps of the sea. Thus it came about that there was a meeting between them on the Tower Hills, and to that meeting with the Numenorians came 12 men only out of Eriador, men of high heart and courage, for most of their people feared that the newcomers were perilous spirits of the dead. But when they looked on the shipmen, fear left them, though for a while they stood silent in awe. For mighty as they were themselves accounted among their kin, the shipmen resembled rather elvish lords than mortal men in bearing and apparel. Nonetheless, they felt no doubt of their ancient kinship. And likewise, the shipmen looked with glad surprise upon the men of Middle-earth. For it had been believed in Numenor, that the men left behind were descended from the evil men who in the last days of the war against Morgoth had been summoned by him out of the east. But now they looked upon faces free from the shadow, and men who could have walked in Numenor and not been thought aliens save in their clothes and their arms. Then suddenly, after the silence, both the Numenoreans and the men of Eriador spoke words of welcome and greeting in their own tongues, as if addressing friends and kinsmen after a long parting. At first they were disappointed, for neither side could understand the other. But when they mingled in friendship, they found that they shared very many words, still clearly recognizable, and others that could be understood with attention, and they were able to converse haltingly about simple matters. Elsewhere, in this essay, it is explained that these men dwelt about Lake Evendim, in the North Downs and the Weather Hills, and in the lands between as far as the Brandywine, west of which they often wandered, though they did not dwell there. They were friendly with the elves, though they held them in awe, and they feared the sea and would not look upon it. It appears that they were in origin men of the same stock as the peoples of Beor and Hador, who had not crossed the Blue Mountains into Beleriand during the First Age. End of note. When Aldarion spoke of this venture, and asked leave to go as soon as the spring winds should be favorable, Meneldor was loath to grant it. A chill came upon him, as though his heart guessed that more hung upon this than his mind could foresee. But when he looked upon the eager face of his son, he let no sign of this be seen.
"Do as your heart calls, Onya," he said. "I shall miss you sorely, but with Veontar as captain, under the grace of the Valar, I shall live in good hope of your return. But do not become enamored of the great lands, you who one day must be king and father of this isle."
Thus it came to pass that on a morning of fair sun and white wind, in the bright spring of the 725th year of the Second Age, the son of the king's heir of Numenor sailed from the land. And ere day was over, he saw it sink, shimmering into the sea, and last of all, the peak of the Meneltarma as a dark finger against the sunset. Note 4. The son of the king's heir, Aldarion, son of Meneldor. Tar Elendil did not resign the scepter to Meneldor until a further 15 years had passed. End of note. It is said that Aldarion himself wrote records of all his journeys to Middle-earth, and they were long preserved in Romena, though all were afterwards lost. Of his first journey little is known, save that he made the friendship of Círdan and Gil-galad, and journeyed far in Lindon, and the west of Eriador, and marveled at all that he saw. He did not return for more than 2 years, and Meneldor was in great disquiet. It is said that his delay was due to the eagerness he had to learn all that he could of Círdan, both in the making and management of ships, and in the building of walls to withstand the hunger of the sea. There was joy in Romana and Armenelos when men saw the great ship, Numeramar, which signifies west wings, coming up from the sea, her golden sails reddened in the sunset. The summer was nearly over, and the Eru Hantale was nigh. Note 5. Eru Hantale. Thanksgiving to Eru. The autumn feast in Numenor. See the description of Numenor, page 166. End of note. It seemed to Meneldor, when he welcomed his son in the house of Veontar, that he had grown in stature, and his eyes were brighter, but they looked far away.
"What did you see, Onya, in your far journeys that now lives most in memory?"
But Aldarion, looking east towards the night, was silent. At last he answered, but softly, as one that speaks to himself. "The fair people of the elves? The green shores? The mountains wreathed in cloud? The regions of mist and shadow beyond guess? I do not know." He ceased, and Meneldor knew that he had not spoken his full mind, for Aldarion had become enamored of the great sea, and of a ship riding there alone without sight of land, borne by the winds with foam at its throat to coasts and havens unguessed. And that love and desire never left him until his life's end. Veontar did not again voyage from Numenor, but the Numeramar he gave in gift to Aldarion. Within 3 years, Aldarion begged leave to go again, and he set sail for Lindon. He was 3 years abroad, and not long after, another voyage he made that lasted for 4 years. For it is said that he was no longer content to sail to Mithlond, but began to explore the coasts southwards, past the mouths of Barandwin, and Gwathla, and Angren. And he rounded the dark cape of Ros Morthil, and beheld the great bay of Belfalis, and the mountains of the country of Amroth, where the Nandor elves still dwell. Note 6. Sir, Angren was the elvish name of the river Isen. Ros Morthil, a name not otherwise found, must be the great headland at the end of the northern arm of the Bay of Belfalis, which was also called Androst, Long Cape. The reference to the country of Amroth, where the Nandor elves still dwell, can be taken to imply that the tale of Aldarion and Arrendis was written down in Gondor before the departure of the last ship, from the haven of the Sylvan Elves near Dol Amroth, in the year 1981 of the Third Age. See pages 240 and the following. End of note. In the 39th year of his age, Aldarion returned to Numenor, bringing gifts from Gil-galad to his father. For in the following year, as he had long proclaimed, Tar-Elendil relinquished the scepter to his son, and Tar-Meneldor became the king. Then Aldarion restrained his desire, and remained at home for a while for the comfort of his father. And in those days he put to use the knowledge he had gained of Círdan concerning the making of ships, devising much anew of his own thought. And he began also to set men to the improvement of the havens and the quays, for he was ever eager to build greater vessels. But the sea longing came upon him anew, and he departed again and yet again from Numenor. And his mind turned now to ventures that might not be compassed with one vessel's company. Therefore he formed the Guild of Venturers, that afterwards was renowned. To that brotherhood were joined all the hardiest and most eager mariners, and young men sought admission to it even from the inland regions of Numenor, and Aldarion they called the Great Captain. At that time he, having no mind to live upon land in Armenelos, had a ship built that should serve as his dwelling place. He named it, therefore, Eombar, and at times he would sail in it from haven to haven of Numenor. But for the most part it lay at anchor off Tol Uinen, and that was a little isle in the Bay of Romena that was set there by Uinen, the Lady of the Seas. Note 7. For Uinen, the spouse of Ose, Mire of the Sea, see the Silmarillion, page 30. There it is said that the Numenorians lived long in her protection, and held her in reverence equal to the Valar. End of note. Upon Eombar was the guildhouse of the venturers, and there were kept the records of their great voyages. For Tar-Meneldor looked coldly on the enterprises of his son, and cared not to hear the tale of his journeys, believing that he sowed the seeds of restlessness, and the desire of other lands to hold. Note 8. It is stated that the guildhouse of the venturers was confiscated by the kings and removed to the western haven of Andunia. All its records perished, that is, in the downfall, including all the accurate charts of Numenor. But it is not said when this confiscation of Eombar took place. End of note. In that time Aldarion became estranged from his father and ceased to speak openly of his designs and his desires. But Almarion, the queen, supported her son in all that he did, and Meneldor perforce let matters go as they must. For the venturers grew in numbers and in the esteem of men, and they called them Uinendili, the lovers of Uinen, and their captain became the less easy to rebuke or restrain. The ships of the Numenorians became ever larger and of greater draught in those days, until they could make far voyages, carrying many men and great cargoes. And Aldarion was often long gone from Numenor. Tar-Meneldor ever opposed his son, and he set a curb on the felling of trees in Numenor for the building of vessels. And it came therefore into Aldarion's mind that he would find timber in Middle-earth, and seek there for a haven for the repair of his ships. In his voyages down the coasts he looked with wonder on the great forests, and at the mouth of the river that the Numenorians called Gwathir, River of Shadow, he established Vinyalonde, the new haven. Note 9. The river was afterwards called Gwathla, or Grey Flood, and the haven, Londdyr. See pages 261 and the following. End of note. But when nigh on 800 years had passed since the beginning of the Second Age, Tarmineldr commanded his son to remain now in Numenor, and to cease for a time his eastward voyaging, for he desired to proclaim Aldarion the king's heir, as had been done at that age of the air by the kings before him. Then Meneldr and his son were reconciled for that time, and there was peace between them, and amid joy and feasting, Aldarion was proclaimed heir in the 100th year of his age, and received from his father the title and power of Lord of the Ships and Havens of Numenor. To the feasting in Armenelos came one Beregar from his dwelling in the west of the isle, and with him came Arrendis, his daughter. There Almarion, the queen, observed her beauty, of a kind seldom seen in Numenor, for Beregar came of the house of Beor by ancient descent, though not of the royal line of Elros, and Arrendis was dark-haired and of slender grace, with the clear gray eyes of her kin. Note 10. Compare the Silmarillion, page 148. The men of that house, that is of Beor, were dark or brown of hair, with gray eyes. According to a genealogical table of the house of Beor, Arrendis was descended from Bareth, who was the sister of Baragund and Belagund, and thus the aunt of Morwen, mother of Turin Turambar, and of Rion, the mother of Tuor. End of note. But Arrendis looked upon Aldarion as he rode by, and for his beauty and splendor of bearing she had eyes for little else. Thereafter, Arrendis entered the household of the queen, and found favor also with the king. But little did she see of Aldarion, who busied himself in the tending of the forests, being concerned that in days to come timber should not lack in Numenor. Ere long the mariners of the Guild of Venturers became restless, for they were ill-content to voyage more briefly and more rarely under lesser commanders. And when 6 years had passed since the proclamation of the king's heir, Aldarion determined to sail again to Middle-earth. Of the king he got but grudging leave, for he refused his father's urging that he abide in Numenor and seek a wife, and he set sail in the spring of the year. But coming to bid farewell to his mother, he saw Arrendis amid the queen's company, and looking on her beauty, he divined the strength that lay concealed in her. Then Almarion said to him, "Must you depart again, Aldarion, my son? Is there nothing that will hold you in the fairest of all mortal lands?" "Not yet," he answered, "but there are fairer things in Armenelos than a man could find elsewhere, even in the lands of the Eldar. But mariners are men of two minds, at war with themselves, and the desire of the sea still holds me." Arrendis believed that these words were spoken also for her ears, and from that time forth her heart was turned wholly to Aldarion, though not in hope. In those days there was no need, by law or custom, that those of the royal house, not even the king's heir, should wed only with descendants of Elros Tarminiatur, but Arrendis deemed that Aldarion was too high. Yet she looked on no man with favor thereafter, and every suitor she dismissed. 7 years passed before Aldarion came back, bringing with him ore of silver and gold, and he spoke with his father of his voyage and his deeds. But Meneldr said, "Rather would I have had you beside me than any news or gifts from the dark lands. This is the part of merchants and explorers, not of the king's heir. What need have we of more silver and gold, unless to use in pride where other things would serve as well? The need of the king's house is for a man who knows and loves this land and people, which he will rule." "Do I not study men all my days?" said Aldarion. "I can lead and govern them as I will." "Say rather, some men, of like mind with yourself," answered the king. "There are also women in Numenor, scarce fewer than men, and save your mother, whom indeed you can lead as you will, what do you know of them? Yet one day you must take a wife." "One day," said Aldarion, "but not before I must. And later, if any try to thrust me towards marriage. Other things I have to do more urgent to me, for my mind is bent on them. Cold is the life of a mariner's wife. and the mariner who is single of purpose and not tied to the shore goes further and learns better how to deal with the sea.
Further, but not with more profit, said Menelder. And you do not deal with the sea, Aldarion, my son? Do you forget that the Edain dwell here under the grace of the lords of the West? That Uinen is kind to us, and Ossa is restrained? Our ships are guarded, and other hands guard them than ours. So be not over-proud, or the grace may wane. And do not presume that it will extend to those who risk themselves without need upon the rocks of strange shores, or in the lands of men of darkness.
To what purpose, then, is the gracing of our ships, said Aldarion, if they are to sail to no shores, and may seek nothing not seen before?
He spoke no more to his father of such matters, but passed his days upon the ship Eombar, in the company of the venturers, and in the building of a vessel greater than any made before. That ship he named Palaron, the Far Wanderer. Yet now he met Arrandis often, and that was by contrivance of the queen. And the king, learning of their meetings, felt disquiet, yet he was not displeased.
It would be more kind to cure Aldarion of his restlessness, said he, before he win the heart of any woman.
How else will you cure him if not by love? Said the queen.
Arrandis is yet young, said Menelder.
But Almarion answered, the kin of Arrandis have not the length of life that is granted to the descendants of Elros, and her heart is already won. Note 11. On different lifespans among the Numenoreans, see Note 1 to the line of Elros, page 224. End of note. Now when the great ship Palaren was built, Aldarion would depart once more. At this Meneldur became wrathful, though by the persuasions of the queen he would not use the king's power to stay him. Here must be told of the custom that when a ship departed from Numenor over the great sea to Middle-earth, a woman, most often of the captain's kin, should set upon the vessel's prow the green bough of return, and that was cut from the tree Oialaire, that signifies ever summer, which the Eldar gave to the Numenoreans, saying that they set it upon their own ships in token of friendship with Ossa and Uenen. Note 12. On the tree Oialaire, see the description of Numenor, page 167. End of note. The leaves of that tree were evergreen, glossy and fragrant, and it throve upon sea air. But Meneldur forbade the queen and the sisters of Aldarion to bear the bough of Oialaire to Romena, where lay the Palaron, saying that he refused his blessing to his son, who was venturing forth against his will. And Aldarion, hearing this, said,
if I must go without blessing or bow, then so I will go.
Then the queen was grieved, but Arrandis said to her, Tarinya, if you will cut the bough from the elven tree, I will bear it to the haven by your leave, for the king has not forbidden it to me. The mariners thought it an ill thing that the captain should depart thus. But when all was made ready and men prepared to weigh anchor, Arrandis came there, little though she loved the noise and bustle of the great harbor and the crying of the gulls. Aldarion greeted her with amazement and joy, and she said, I have brought you the bow of return, lord, from the queen.
From the queen? Said Aldarion, in a changed manner.
Yes, lord, she said, but I asked for her leave to do so. Others beside your own kin will rejoice at your return, as soon as may be. At that time Aldarion first looked on Arrandis with love, and he stood long in the stern looking back as the Palaren passed out to sea. It is said that he hastened his return, and was gone less time than he had designed, and coming back he brought gifts for the queen and the ladies of her house, but the richest gift he brought for Arrandis, and that was a diamond. Cold now were the greetings between the king and his son, and Meneldur rebuked him, saying that such a gift was unbecoming in the king's heir unless it were a betrothal gift, and he demanded that Aldarion declare his mind. In gratitude I brought it, said he, for a warm heart amid the coldness of others.
Cold hearts may not kindle others to give them warmth at their goings and comings, said Meneldur,
and again he urged Aldarion to take thought of marriage, though he did not speak of Arrandis. But Aldarion would have none of it, for he was ever and in every course the more opposed as those about him urged it. And treating Arrandis now with greater coolness, he He determined to leave Numenor and further his designs in Vinyalande. Life on land was irksome to him, for aboard his ship he was subject to no other will, and the venturers who accompanied him knew only love and admiration for the great captain. But now Meneldor forbade his going, and Audarion, before the winter was fully gone, set sail with a fleet of 7 ships and the greater part of the venturers, in defiance of the king. The queen did not dare incur Meneldor's wrath, but at night a cloaked woman came to the haven bearing a bough, and she gave it into the hands of Aldarion, saying, "This comes from the Lady of the Westlands," for so they called Arrendis, and went away in the dark. At the open rebellion of Aldarion, the king rescinded his authority as lord of the ships and havens of Numenor, and he caused the guildhouse of the venturers on Eambar to be shut, and the shipyards of Romenna to be closed, and forbade the felling of all trees for shipbuilding. 5 years passed, and Aldarion returned with 9 ships, for 2 had been built in Vinyalande, and they were laden with fine timber from the forests of the coasts of Middle-earth. The anger of Aldarion was great when he found what had been done, and to his father he said, "If I am to have no welcome in Numenor, and no work for my hands to do, and if my ships may not be repaired in its havens, then I will go again, and soon, for the winds have been rough, and I need refitment." Note 13. This is to be understood as a portent. End of note. "Has not a king's son ought to do but study women's faces to find a wife? The work of forestry I took up, and I have been prudent in it. There will be more timber in Numenor ere my day ends than there is under your scepter." And true to his word, Aldarion left again in the same year with 3 ships, and the hardiest of the venturers, going without blessing or bow. For Meneldor set a ban on all the women of his house and of the venturers, and put a guard about Romenna. On that voyage, Aldarion was away so long that the people feared for him, and Meneldor himself was disquieted, despite the grace of the Valar that had ever protected the ships of Numenor. Note 14. Compare the Akalabeth, the Silmarillion, page 277, where it is told that in the days of Ar-Pharazôn, ever and anon a great ship of the Numenorians would founder and not return to haven, though such a grief had not till then befallen them since the rising of the star. End of note. When 10 years were gone since his sailing, Arrendis at last despaired, and believing that Aldarion had met with disaster, or else that he had determined to dwell in Middle-earth, and also in order to escape the importuning of suitors, she asked the queen's leave, and departing from Armenelos, she returned to her own kindred in the Westlands. But after 4 years more, Aldarion at last returned, and his ships were battered and broken by the seas. He had sailed first to the haven of Vinyalande, and thence he had made a great coastwise journey southwards, far beyond any place yet reached by the ships of the Numenorians. But returning northwards, he had met contrary winds and great storms, and scarce escaping shipwreck in the Harad, found Vinyalande overthrown by great seas and plundered by hostile men. 3 times he was driven back from the crossing of the great sea by high winds out of the west, and his own ship was struck by lightning and dismasted. And only with labor and hardship in the deep waters did he come at last to haven in Numenor. Greatly was Meneldor comforted at Aldarion's return, but he rebuked him for his rebellion against king and father, thus forsaking the guardianship of the Valar, and risking the wrath of Ossë, not only for himself, but for men whom he had bound to himself in devotion. Then Aldarion was chastened in mood, and he received the pardon of Meneldor, who restored to him the lordship of the ships and havens, and added thereto the title of Master of the Forests. Aldarion was grieved to find Arrendis gone from Armenelos, but he was too proud to seek her, and indeed he could not well do so save to ask for her in marriage, and he was still unwilling to be bound. He set himself to the repairing of the neglects of his long absence, for he had been nigh on 20 years away, and at that time great harbor works were put in hand, especially at Romenna. He found that there had been much felling of trees for building and the making of many things, but all was done without foresight, and little had been planted to replace what was taken. And he journeyed far and wide in Numenor to view the standing woods. Riding one day in the forests of the Westlands, he saw a woman whose dark hair flowed in the wind, and about her was a green cloak clasped at the throat with a bright jewel, and he took her for one of the Eldar, who came at times to those parts of the island. But she approached, and he knew her for Arrendis, and saw that the jewel was the one that he had given her. Then suddenly he knew in himself the love that he bore her, and he felt the emptiness of his days. Arrendis, seeing him, turned pale and would ride off, but he was too quick, and he said, "Too well have I deserved that you should flee from me, who have fled so often and so far. But forgive me, and stay now." They rode then together to the house of Beregar, her father, and there Aldarion made plain his desire for betrothal to Arrendis. But now Arrendis was reluctant, though according to custom and the life of her people, it was now full time for her marriage. Her love for him was not lessened, nor did she retreat out of guile, but she feared now in her heart that in the war between herself and the sea for the keeping of Aldarion, she would not conquer. Never would Arrendis take less, that she might not lose all. And fearing the sea, and begrudging to all ships the felling of trees which she loved, she determined that she must utterly defeat the sea and the ships, or else be herself defeated utterly. But Aldarion wooed Arrendis in earnest, and wherever she went, he would go. He neglected the havens and the shipyards, and all the concerns of the guild adventurers, felling no trees but setting himself to their planting only. And he found more contentment in those days than in any others of his life, though he did not know it until he looked back long after when old age was upon him. At length he sought to persuade Arrendis to sail with him on a voyage about the island in the ship Eombar. For 100 years had now passed since Aldarion founded the Guild of Venturers, and feasts were to be held in all the havens of Numenor. To this Arrendis consented, concealing her distaste and fear, and they departed from Romena and came to Andunia in the west of the isle. There Valindil, lord of Andunia and close kin of Aldarion, held a great feast, and at that feast he drank to Arrendis, naming her Uinenio, daughter of Uinen, the new lady of the sea. Note 15. Valindil was Aldarion's cousin, for he was the son of Silmarion, daughter of Tar-Elendil, and sister of Tar-Meneldir. Valindil, first of the lords of Andunia, was the ancestor of Elendil the Tall, father of Isildur and Anarion. End of note. But Arrendis, who sat beside the wife of Valindil, said aloud, "Call me by no such name. I am no daughter of Uinen. Rather is she my foe,